I'm going to talk about loading deep feature hierarchy. So this is kind of a follow-up on Russ Shakutinov's talk yesterday. So it's got a similar things. I'm going to talk about the similar philosophies, but sort of with different methods. And I should mention that this is work I haven't done because it's done mostly by my students, Marco Yuanzato and Sumit Chopra are actually here, and Ilan Bourreau and Fiji Wong are like in New York. Okay, so one of the things I've been obsessed with is computer vision, not because I'm particularly interested in computer vision, you know, that's kind of a shock to you guys, but because I think it's one of the most challenging problems for machine learning. If you can solve vision with learning, you can probably solve anything you want with learning. And so I use vision as sort of the best way of testing learning algorithms. Because, you know, everything is complicated in vision. It's a high dimension, it's very sparse, you've got really complicated invariances, and you've got, you know, problems like this, right? So the human visual system is capable of recognizing objects, categories. After having trained on very, very few examples, we were able to recognize objects that build into categories, and we've never seen those objects before. I can guess that probably a good proportion of the audience here has never seen those weird contraptions here, but has no problem identifying them as things that are intended to fly, even if they don't. So how is it that we can learn representations, sort of high-level representations, abstract representations, in a way that allows us to recognize those as flying contractions? Or allows us to recognize objects that are widely different from what we've seen before and still identify their function or purpose or category. So I'm sad to say both the machine learning community and the computer vision community, although they sort of somewhat advertised to be interested in that problem, they really haven't been working on it very much. And it's because it's too hard. And so the computer vision community has really attached itself to trying to solve this particular problem for vision. But there is this similar problem for addition. There's a similar problem for language. There's a similar problem for all kinds of, you know, perceptual modalities and for control and for just about everything you can think of as kind of intelligent behavior. And there's this idea that's floating around among neuroscientists, a few neuroscientists, certainly among certain psychologists, that there is some sort of universal learning rule that the brain uses. You look at the neocortex and it's pretty much the same stuff all over. You know, there's no difference in anatomy, there's no difference in physiology. It's pretty much the same stuff going on everywhere in the brain. And so you would think that the brain has come up with some sort of solution to learn whatever function it needs to learn, regardless of what the nature of the the signal that it's looking at. And there are kind of a few interesting characteristics about sort of the best example of learning systems that we have in front of us. The brain of mammals or animals in general, just about every animal can learn. So let's take the primate visual cortex, for example. It's got about 10 to 20 layers, we don't really know, but it's about that, depending on how you count. So if you want to go from the retina to the infratemporal cortex, which is where objects are represented, you have to go through about 20 layers of neurons. Okay? And each layer of neuron performs a really highly nonlinear operation. So if you think about that system, it's a very highly nonlinear system, very complicated. And somehow, there is a learning algorithm that trains this machine, and we don't have anything that comes anywhere close to this kind of efficiency for a highly nonlinear system like this, okay? I'd say two-thirds of, if not more, of the machine learning community is stuck in sort of optimizing convex functions with linear parameterization or quadratic parameterization. So we need to get beyond that if we want to solve problems like this. And so I'm still trying to kind of advertise that. So is there a universal learning algorithm or architecture that we could devise that would sort of do similar things that the brain does? And some people have been looking for it for a while, but haven't found it, unfortunately. But there's kind of a nugget of hope now with this idea of deep belief nets that Russ talked about yesterday. So the alternative to sort of finding a universal learning algorithm to kind of solve artificial intelligence problems is to, of course, build specialized modules for every new problem we're facing. And that's largely what every community within sort of AI at large has been doing for the last 50 years or so. Okay, so one question we should ask ourselves is, the brain is kind of a deep system, but do we really need a deep system? Is the brain a deep system because, with many layers, because of constraints of biology, because, you know, it's got to fit in the brain or something, in the brain case, or is it because of sort of deep mathematical reasons? And if you talk to a lot of machine learning people and mathematicians, you would be tended to believe that mathematics would suggest you really don't need deep systems. So if you use kernel methods, for example, right, you want to approximate a function this way by weighted sum of sort of similarity measures between, or dissimilarity measures between all your training samples and the incoming vector. That's pretty much universal. You can pretty much approximate any function over the training samples that you want with this, provided you choose the right kernel, provided you set the alphas correctly. But you can essentially approximate any function you want with this. Okay. Similarly, if you are interested in neural networks, this is kind of a abstract function for a two-layer neural net. So you've got some nonlinear transformation, the dot product between a matrix vector product. So this is the input vector, the weight matrix at the first layer, some nonlinear transformation, the weight matrix at the second layer, another nonlinear transformation. And you can show that, under sort of reasonable assumption about what this function can be, you can pretty much, if the dimension of the intermediate vector here is large enough, the number of rows of that matrix, you can pretty much approximate any function as close as you want. Okay? So here you can approximate anything on the training set. Here you can approximate anything as long as you are willing to pay the price. Why would you need anything else? And when you look at the structure of a deep learning machine, say a deep neural net, if you kind of simplify a neural net that's kind of feed-forward architectures, you know, it's a lot more complicated. It's got lots of layers. So it's, you know, it's a function of a linear function, a function of a linear function, a function of a linear function, et cetera. You get a whole bunch of them, as many as you have layers. So that looks a bit more complicated. And if you can avoid using it, you should. But I'm going to argue that you can't really avoid it if you want to build intelligent machines, if you want. And the reason is because deep machines are more efficient for representing certain classes of functions, particularly the ones that are involved in things like visual recognition and other tasks that we might be interested in. In what sense are they more efficient? They're more efficient because they require less hardware or virtual hardware, or fewer stuff, right? Fewer things, fewer kind of modules in them. So what we need to do if we want to build sort of trainable intelligent machines is to kind of parameterize a set of functions that can sort of cover the set of a set that we call the AI set, which is the set of all the functions that sort of, you know, the typical mammalian brain can do, right? Say a rat. Okay, we're not going to build machines that are as powerful as human brain, but let's start with a rat. Okay, the rat has about 50 million neurons that should be kind of small enough that we can do this within our lifetime. So
50 million.
It's between 15 and 50. We don't really know, but it's kind of on that order of magnitude. And about 1,000 to 10,000 synapses per neuron. I mean, there are machines that are big enough to run this in real time.
Million or million?
Million. It's pretty small. Yeah. A mouse is 5 million. It's pretty small. And they can do pretty amazing thing with that little hardware, right?
And just to say hardware, you mean total number of parameters? In the W's?
Dimensions, amount of computation you have to do. So for example, you have a two-layer neural net, you have a certain number of heat units, that's kind of the hardware, right? That determines how much computation you need to do to compute the outputs. Yeah.
So fewer hidden units in the deep machine.
Right.
Total.
Right. Okay. So
the really impressive thing is that the power consumption is less than a watt.
Yeah, for rats, you mean. Yeah, rats are really efficient. Well, let's even take like a fly or a bee. You know, a bee has like less than a million neurons, maybe 100,000, between 100,000 and a million neurons, and it's less than a gram. It's amazing. Anyway, so what's interesting about deep architectures is that they trade space for time. You know, so I kind of feel funny to sort of say this now, because for a lot of us who kind of were involved in sort of machine learning the other day of neural nets, this is why people got involved in neural nets in the first place. And now everybody has forgotten everything about this. So this is the talk I was giving 20 years ago, basically. So deep architectures trade space for time. So if you have more layers, the computation is sort of more sequential as opposed to kind of more parallel if you have kind of a shallow architecture. So it's kind of a depth-breadth trade-off, right? You can implement a particular function with lots and lots and lots of parallel elements, or with sort of fewer parallel elements but sort of more steps, if you want, okay? And you always have that trade-off even when you write a program. You know, you can use more memory but less time or whatever. So let's take an example. Let's say NP parity, right? So you need kind of a reasonable design for a circuit that would compute the NP parity. Would be a tree of n minus 1 XOR gates. Okay, so you take the first two bits, do an XOR, the next pair of bits, do an XOR, and then you do an XOR of the results, and at the end you get the whether you have a odd or even number of bits that are equal to 1 on the input, right? So basically with the depth of log n and n gates, you get away with it. Now, what if you want to implement it in just two layers? You can do it, of course. You can always write the Boolean formula as the Boolean formula in the disjointed normal form, or you know, DNF or CNF. So you can always do it in two layers with ands and ors, and unfortunately that takes an exponential number of terms. Okay, so that's a case where it's a clear advantage to add a few more layers in terms of number of hardware you need to run the function. Of course, it's going to be slower; it's going to be log n instead of two. But you know, it's a huge advantage in hardware. Another example is addition of two n-bit binary numbers requires order of n gates and order of n layers if you implement it using you know, full bit one-bit adder, and you do a ripple carry. Okay, so the carry takes n steps to get through. So it's like n layers if you want. We can always implement it in two layers as well. It's just going to take a very large number of minterms. I think it's not exponential in that case, but it's still big. All right. Now, the bad news is that almost all Boolean functions have a DNF formula with an exponential number of minterms. Okay? And you don't need any proof for this. You know, we just write all Boolean functions as combinational minterms, and most of them have a lot of minterms. They have the one that have a small number of minterms. It's only a few of them because you can only have a few combinations of small number of interests. Okay, so almost all functions are really hairy. So what strategies can we adopt to kind of attack this problem? And I'm sort of paraphrasing Jeff Hinton, who kind of wrote something a bit like this in one of his recent papers. So the first possible strategy is defeatism. Since there is no good parameterization of the AI set, let's just parameterize much smaller sets for each specific task through careful engineering. So basically, you know, you're faced with a computer vision problem, you know, come up with a really kind of cool representation for the images using SIFT features, and you know, throw all the bags of features that you can, all the features you can imagine in your system, and then use kind of a pretty generic classifier on top of it, for vector machine, whatever. Okay? And that's the approach that most people use these days. And I shouldn't call it defeatism because it's actually the method that works the best at the moment in computer vision. So there's nothing wrong with that. That's the best way to get the best results. Okay, but in the long run, it's kind of painful because you kind of have to redo this for every new problem. The second approach is denial. And denial is that you know, a kernel machine that can approximate anything we want, and the VC bounds guarantee generalization, so we don't need anything else. You know, life is good. Unfortunately, there's a slight problem, which is that kernel machines with sort of the usual kernels that everybody use can only represent a very tiny subset of functions efficiently. Well, in the space of all possible functions, the subset that a particular kernel machine with a particular kernel can represent is incredibly small. tiny.
That's
right, but you know, you're not going to have more than the number of training samples anyway, so that's actually...
You should specify the sentence.
True. Well, I should say efficiently, right?
Efficiently.
That's what it means. So, you know, you choose a kernel, you're making an assumption about what kind of functions you can represent efficiently. That's it. And there is no way to escape that. That's the no-free lunch theorem. If there was a general way of representing functions, we would know about it. I mean, it doesn't exist, you know? It's just not.
Are you thinking about the native space?
About?
Native space.
I'm not sure you're referring to. Okay, and then the third option, which kind of that's what I've been sticking with for 20 years, which may be can be stupid, is optimism, or you could say naive optimism, is that we should look for learning models that can be applied to the largest possible subset of the AI set while requiring the smallest amount of task-specific knowledge for each task. And so, you know, the reason for optimism, for boundless optimism, is that we at least have a few examples of this happening in the animal world. Or in humans. All right.
Yeah,
so
I don't think I know really what you mean by the AI set. I mean, I think I know, but could you say what you mean by the AI set?
Well, it's all the tasks that an animal of your choice can learn. Okay. But current computers can't. Right. So, for example. You know, robots these days, can't really drive outside without bumping into stuff and really efficiently and sort of identifying obstacles and, you know, and you take a jumping spider, which is about this big, you can barely see it, it's got two big eyes with 15 pixels each or something like that, and they can identify prey pretty far away, and they can plan the kind of a 3D path, you know, jumping from branch to branch to actually catch them. So they go from the back, so the prey doesn't see them, and then pounce on them to eat them, right? And they can do this with 100,000 neurons. So I mean, really stupid. I mean, there's something really wrong with the way we're doing things, right? Okay. So the bad news is that the machine learning community today oscillates between defeatism and denial, and really not many people are kind of belong to that category, or kind of you know, someone are in the some people are in the closet. Okay, so the first bad news, of course, is that deep learning is hard. So what I'm arguing is that you know the solution to this, of course, is that we should look for learning algorithms that can deal with this really very highly nonlinear complex functions, right? And this is a really good question for mathematicians, the mathematicians in the room, because no one has figured it out yet really well. So deep learning is hard. So let's take the simplest deep neural net you can think of. It's actually not deep, it's got only two layers. And so it's got one input, one hidden unit, and one output, and just one weight connecting the input to the hidden unit, and one weight connecting the hidden unit to the output, okay? And we're going to train it to compute the identity function, okay? So we want to map 0.5 to 0.5 and minus 0.5 to minus 0.5. All right, so it's the simplest thing you can imagine, right? And so the last function is going to be, you know, 0.5, which is the desired output, minus the output you get from the neural net, and it's, you know, hyperbolic tangent of the second weight times hyperbolic tangent of the first weight times 0.5, which is the input. And there's another term like this with minus 0.5, which is the same thing, square, okay, just a square error. I forgot a parenthesis here. I forgot two parentheses, all right. Now, plot this function. It looks like this, okay, in the space of W1, W2, it looks like this. So basically what you want is W0, W1. What you want is W0 to be kind of 1 over W1 if you want. Okay, that's kind of the solution space. Solution space is some sort of hyperbola. And so that's the solution space. You can have both W's positive or both W's negative. There's another groove here in the back. 0, 0 is in the middle. And you have a saddle point here. Okay? And this is sort of a horribly non-convex ill-conditioned, badly-behaved cost function for the simplest multi-layer neural net you can imagine. Okay, so people saw this about 10, 15 years ago and said, you know, neural nets are never going to work. You know, let's do something else, right? But in fact, it's kind of so. Here is kind of an intuition that really misleads people, which is that this sort of views in low dimensions are extremely misleading. In high dimension, the problem is actually simpler than that. And the reason is because it's very difficult to actually build local minima in high dimension with lots of elements like this. So if when you build a multilayer neural net with sort of a very wide hidden layers, the likelihood of having local minima you can't escape is very low. The reason is because the dimension of the space is so large, there is always a way to get out of a local minimum. You know, there's no way to kind of fence in a local minimum with all the walls all around in all the dimensions. And so local minima really don't exist. It's not much of a problem in sort of wide neural nets. But it is a problem in sort of skinny, tall neural nets. That's a problem. So the last surface is non-convex, it's a condition, it's got saddle points, it's got flat spots, and this loss function is particularly horrible for tall and skinny networks, but it's not that bad for sort of short, fat networks, which are not deep, in a sense.
When you say tall and skinny, I mean, what do I think? You know, you were talking about mammalian brain with 10 layers with, you know,
So those ones are tall and fat.
Right. Okay.
So there is actually a sort of 50-to-1 expansion from the optical nerve to the V1. There's a lot more neurons in the visual cortex in parallel than you have afferences. So it gets really, really fat quickly, and it sort of gets narrower as you go up the layers. But it's really not a tall, skinny layer system. It's a tall and fat.
But that's still tall.
So it's still a problem. Right? You can't train those things with sort of traditional neural net learning algorithms.
I mean, the aspect ratio is.
Yeah.
You've got millions to 10. So.
Right.
Some bits are quite good with that.
That's true. Yeah. But 10 is the problem. Okay. So actually, I think there are two big problems in machine learning, and one of them. So the first one is essentially ignored by the machine learning community these days, or even sort of actively repressed, I should say. And the second one is actually very, very studied quite a lot. Okay, so the first problem is the deep learning problem, which I just mentioned. And the second problem is the intractable partition function problem. So it's the problem that when you're trying to train probabilistic systems, you kind of have to normalize your probability distribution, and that's usually a very difficult thing to do in high-dimensional spaces. And I have a feeling that, if you sort of heard Russ's talk, there is a feeling that we're not going to be able to solve this problem without solving this one as well. So it's kind of a double whammy. All right, so let's talk a bit about deep supervised learning. And I go very fast because a lot of people are going to seen this. So you can actually train deep neural net supervised to some extent with some success if you put some structure in them. And this is some old work, so I just want to show you that it's possible. So I'm not going to show you the details of what the architectures are, but there are typical networks like this that have 7 layers or so, 6 or 7 layers, like 8 layers. There's a lot of structure in them. They are sort of mildly inspired by the architecture of the visual cortex, and these are for the purpose of recognizing images. Okay. And different people have different names for it, conventional nets or time-behavior neural nets for the temporal version, HMAX at MIT, or standard model even.
I don't want to rattle too much on this, but when you're training it, you have the random variations in. What I'm getting at is the biological motivation. All of these animals learn from piecewise continuous inputs, and you're circading and then you're looking at continuous variation.
Uh-huh.
And most of the training algorithms that I hear about act as though you have some IID rather than a community thing. And is there something you can do from can you make a benefit you can get from the fact that it's piecewise continuous?
Well, it's even worse than this because animals actually don't learn. I mean, there's not much supervised learning in sort of the animal world. A lot of it is unsupervised reinforcement learning. So you get very little explicit supervisory signals. And a lot of the algorithms we talk about are supervised algorithms, right? And there is something wrong with this, so I'm going to come to that. as well. So some people argue that the fact that you actually get immediate changes, small changes in the scenes, help a lot to drive the learning, particularly unsupervised learning. And there are actually models of sort of low-level feature learning based on sort of the sort of slow feature characteristics, which are the criteria, which are based on this idea that feature representations should change relatively slowly to as a way of sort of driving the invariance of feature extraction.
But you won't be talking about
that? I'm not going to talk about that. So, again, I don't want to go into details of this, and this is old work, and probably many of you have seen that kind of stuff before. So you can build systems like this with several hundred thousand or several million free parameters in them, and plug in an image at the input, propagate through, compute the discrepancy between the input you want, the output you want, and the output you get, compute the gradient of this error with respect to all the parameters in the system, and do an update. And the algorithms that are best for this are the ones that Leon Boutou talked about yesterday. Stochastic gradient descent with some preconditioning. Okay. And this works really well. So for phase detection, it's probably as good as any method. I can't resist showing you the demo. Most of you probably seen this. Who hasn't seen this? Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll keep this anyway. I can't resist. And Mark is good. Oh, not again.
No.
Okay. All right. So this is a real-time phase detector based on this control. So I can't, the wire is kind of short, and the minimum size of the faces that can be detected is kind of big, so it's not good. Alright, here you go. Okay. So this guy actually does not just face detection, but also pose estimation. So it puts a crosshair between your eyes. And so it figures out which way you're pointing, and it's also part, it's trained also as part of the system. So we can do object recognition with this as well, but the problem with doing object recognition with architectures like this is that you need lots and lots of examples. So we collected this small data set a few years ago, which consists of 50 objects total, 25 of which we use for training and 25 we use for tests. So it's got five categories: animals, humans, airplanes, trucks, and cars. And we take pictures of those objects under every viewpoint, different lighting conditions, and we use half of the objects for training, the other half for tests. So there are different instances for tests. So it's really sort of category level object recognition. So we've got about 1,000 images of each of the, actually they're stereo pairs, of each of those objects, which kind of, and then we can sort of lift the objects off of their background, which is uniform, and slap them onto sort of busy background or kind of texture background to generate more examples. And we can sort of distort them, change the contrast, the illumination, and various things. So we can generate lots of examples this way. And we use one of those conventional nets to plug on this. This one is about 100,000 free parameters. The amount of computation it takes to compute an output from the input is about 4 million multiply ads. Okay, so it's not that big. And it's just trained with stochastic gradient descent from end to end. Okay, so it's got coefficients all the way through. It's a neural net essentially. It's got coefficients all the way through. All those coefficients are adjusted using gradient descent. So you take the sort of simple version of those objects, the one that are on uniform background, and you plug it into this conventional net. You get something like 6% error on the test set. So these are on the objects it hasn't seen before. If you use things like linear classifiers, super vector machine, get about 12% or 11% or so. Linear classifiers, 30%. And the funny thing is that it takes a lot longer to train the SVM than to train the conventional net. So So if you were to kind of run the, and this is not using the Leon's super fast algorithm that he talked about yesterday. This is using kind of a previous incarnation, which is kind of significantly slower. So this, you know, the numbers might be different with those new methods. But if you were to train the support vector machine on a 1 gigahertz machine, it would take 480 minutes. The convolutional net takes about 64 minutes to get to the same level of accuracy. And if you keep training at the same time, you're going to get much lower error. Okay? So despite the fact that the loss function is high-dimensional, non-convex, badly behaved, ill-conditioned, there is no bound, there's no vapid bound, or there are vapid bounds for neural nets, but they're not as good as tight as for SVMs, if anyone cares about the tightness of bounds. And despite all that, it's a lot faster, and it works better. So I'll come back to that. Just keep that in mind. Okay. So if you go to the more complex situation with texture backgrounds, now the training set has 291,000 samples generated from those original, 50,000 or 20,000 images or so. Then it gets worse. So the convolutional net, stays within the same kind of range of accuracy, 8% or so. But the SVM just completely breaks down. Again, Leon might be able to get better results on this. I'm not sure, but probably not much better than this. And there's kind of a similar chart as I had before. The SVM that gives you 43% error takes an enormous amount of time to give you the wrong answer. Whereas this guy, reaches its peak in sort of about a fifth of the time that it takes for the SVM to train. And in the end, this convolutional net takes 50 times is 50 times faster to test a new sample than with the SVM. Okay, so faster to train, faster to test. It works a little better. It's got all the advantages.
Can I just check something? This is random initialization.
Yes.
And stochastic gradient descent it's not stochastic in the sense that it will jump out of the basin convergence that you start.
No, I mean, it will occasionally do it, but not really.
In general, it's about going downhill in the basin that you start.
Yeah, I mean, there is some jitter, of course, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is interesting.
So the thing is, you get the same result every time, right? I mean, you don't get the same solution every time, but you get the same, pretty much the same accuracy every time. So you get in a different pattern of attraction, but the level of the error is pretty much the same for every starting point. And that's due to this really high dimensional space, the fact that there is lots of equivalent minima, essentially. There's a lot of, extra dimensions, basically, that the system can use to kind of find a good solution. Okay, so what's the difference between what makes the difference between those two? It's the fact that super vector machines are essentially glorified template matchers. Basically, you compare the input sample to all the training samples using a Gaussian Gaussian similarity Gaussian bump. Basically, this is using Gaussian kernels, and then you take the score of all those comparisons and you take a linear combination of those scores, and that's your discriminant function. So it's basically template matching with a little twist on it. Okay. There's no way global template matching like this can solve invariant object recognition unless it's got a lot of templates. And you end up with 5% of the training samples being super vectors there. Probably for it to work, you would have to have even if you had all the training samples as super vectors, you would still not get the results. Template matching just cannot solve this problem. Okay. The second problem is that it's a shadow architecture, so it can't use the sort of refinement of sort of more and more abstract representations to kind of get the invariance and proper representation for the objects. So that's the difference. This guy has a little bit of knowledge about what it's looking at. This guy doesn't care that what it's looking at is pixels. This guy is deep. And that's what makes it work better. Okay, so again, those of you who haven't seen it, which is probably for this one, I got a demo of that as well. So I've got a box of toys here, which I agree with me, which actually I forgot this time, but fortunately my colleague will kind of go ahead from that. So,
Turn on the light,
not necessarily. Well, I should put the camera right side up, that would help. Okay, yeah. Yeah, maybe we should turn on the light. That's
oh,
okay.
All
right. Okay, so. Okay, that's a plane. Well, sometimes it's not a plane. Okay. And let me take another look right here. Okay, this little GI Joe. It's kind of misleading them. Okay, so this is not a detector, it's a recognizer. So it's gonna, so it actually fires on a lot of things that are not any of the categories it's been trained on. And you know, I've got a whole bunch of this little cavalry or whatever. And that's clearly human. Okay. So this is, you know, real time closed invariant so generic lighting invariant, somewhat background invariant, but not really object recognition. This is not really solving the vision problem in the sense that, you know, it only handles five categories, it needs those few hundred thousand training samples to work on, and it doesn't really do a good job of detecting. So, you know, if I point it at a card here, it's going to detect all kinds of objects that are not there. Right, so it's really not, it says human, but it's so we're putting it not there yet, but you can also use those networks to drive robots, but I'm not going to show that unless you got something. Okay, so the problem with this kind of supervised learning approach is that you need a lot of examples. And so how do we fix this? Basically using unsupervised learning. And that's kind of the point that Russ sort of made yesterday, but not quite. So so I'm going to repeat something that I learned from Jeff Hinton. He says, I got to get the numbers right. So the human brain has roughly 10 to the 14 synapses, okay? 10 to the 14 free parameters, if you will. Okay? Although the effective number of free parameters is probably a lot smaller, but that's kind of the rough example. And we live for about 10 to the 9 seconds. And so, you know, even if this kind of cycle time of the brain is like a millisecond, it's still only 10 to the 12 examples, or 10 to the 14 parameters. So you can't actually train your brain in your lifetime if you use supervised learning. There's just not enough information. And it's not like you get a supervisory signal, you know, 1,000 times a second, okay? So something else has to take place to kind of fill all those parameters. And Hinton argues that's unsupervised learning. Okay, so what's unsupervised learning? So unsupervised learning, basically, is people might disagree, but the way I would define it is it's a box, and you give it vectors, and it gives you numbers, and whenever it sees a vector that is similar to something it's seen before, it's been trained on, it gives you a small number, okay, and whenever it's something it's never seen before that's completely different from anything it's seen before, it gives you a large number. So versions of this, so you can do this, so the probabilistic view of this, you know, you have to reverse the interpretation of the number, but it's density estimation, okay? So this is the space of possible things you can see, and if something you see looks like something you've seen before, you output a high probability, and if it doesn't look like anything you've seen before, you output a low probability, and it's like learning a density. So learning a density is one way of doing unsupervised learning. If you want to prefer to think in terms of energy, you can sort of flip this around and use kind of an energy, which is kind of a negative log of that, if you want. And so you get a low number for things you've seen, a high number for things you've not seen. Okay, so what is unsupervised learning all about? And you can sort of seamlessly go from one to the other, provided that you can compute this normalizing integral, you can turn an energy into a probability, provided you can do that using the distribution. Okay, so so how do you train an unsupervised system? Basically, you show it examples, and you train the parameters of that function. You parameterize that function, and you train that function in such a way that it gives low numbers for training samples and high numbers for everything else. And training a function to give low numbers for training samples is fairly easy. The complicated part is to make it produce high number for everything else, because there's a lot of possible everything else's. Okay? If the dimension of y is large, then you have to push up on a lot of different values to make sure the energy of samples you don't see is high everywhere. And that's the partition function problem. That's the problem I was mentioning, the problem number two in machine learning I was talking about. Okay. All right, so the probabilistic way of doing this is to write down the loss function, which is the log, the negative log of the likelihood of the data under the model. Okay. So the log of the likelihood of the data under the model is just the energy. But there is the log of the normalization term, this partition function, okay? So that's your loss function. If you minimize this loss function, it's going to make the energy of the training samples low. This is the sum over training samples of the energy that your model gives to each training sample, okay? So it's going to try to push down on all those terms. It's going to try to push down on that term, but that will have the effect of pushing up on all those energies here, okay? So basically, it's going to try to push up on the energy of everything. Minimizing this loss function will push up on the energy of everything, except the training samples for which the energy is going to be pushed down. And the force you know, going up produced by this guy is less than the force going down produced by that guy, so that overall it's going to be a groove around the training samples. So the problem, of course, is you can't compute this integral, because y might be a high-dimensional space, and you can't really compute that. Unless you kind of, you know, make a conspiracy so that e is simple enough that you can compute the integral, but then it's not an interesting model anymore. Again?
Where does E come?
Well, it comes from you, okay? You have to dream it up. We'll talk about this. All right? That's a lot of the question. But right now, the discussion is general. Okay, so one way of minimizing this is through gradient descent, right? So you compute the derivative of this loss with respect to the parameters, the W in this energy function, and you get the derivative of this with respect to W, which is a Jacobian of this guy, which presumably you can compute, hopefully. And then you get the integral of all the gradients of all the points with respect to the parameter weighted by their probability with a negative sign in front. Okay? So this is the up force that's generated. Okay, and this guy you can compute. So how do you solve that problem? Well, so how do we make the energy everywhere else larger? How do you make sure the second term works? And the Toronto solution to this is sampling. But then again, it's a joke I make all the time. The solution to everything in Toronto is sampling. So, is that true? okay, so here is the trick, and this is a really smart trick. Basically, you pull down on the energy of the training samples. Okay, so show a training sample, compute the gradient of the energy with respect to the parameters at that training sample, push down on it. Okay. And you pull up, what you're going to pull up on is not the energy of every other configurations, but only the ones that are nearby and threatening. Okay, so what you're going to do is you're going to run a little Markov chain Monte Carlo process, perhaps, that's going to pick another point nearby your training sample that happens to have low energy, relatively speaking, but it's not too far away, and you're going to pull that up. Okay? So start from that point, move away a little bit, and pull that up. And the result is that, you know, since you're starting always from a training sample, you're going to have some sort of groove, some sort of local minimum, local kind of, you know, manifold of low energy in the space of y's around the training samples. Very far away from the training samples, the energy is going to be whatever it wants to be. Okay, but nearby, at least, you're going to have some sort of local minimum. So this trick is called contrastive divergence, and Jeff Hinton came up with it a few years ago. And the algorithm is really simple, right? Basically, you have to have a process for generating bad configurations, starting from the correct the training sample value for y, and then you pull up on that. Right. Okay, so now we're going to talk about how do we parameterize E. and what particular architectures are interesting for the kind of stuff we want to do. Okay? And one particularly interesting architecture is the so-called encoder-decoder architecture. So the one that the type of stuff that Russ talked about yesterday actually is of that category. It wasn't clear in his talk, but actually it is. So the architecture is like this. You start with a vector y, run it through an encoding function. Let's say for the sake of simplicity, this will be just a matrix. Okay, so you take the input vector multiplied by a matrix. Okay, and you get some value here. And then you have some other vector here, z, which is going to run through a decoder. For the sake of simplicity, again, that could be just a matrix. And then what you're going to measure is the difference between the reconstructed y, starting from that code, and the original y, okay? And it's going to be one term in the E function of the energy. The other term in the E function is going to be the difference between whatever this encoder produces and whatever the value of z is, okay? So your energy function now is E of y, z, and w. This is a z variable, okay? So to take out z, we can do one of two things. We can marginalize it away, or we can minimize it away. And we're going to minimize it away just to make it simple, okay? So we're going to compute the value of z that minimizes this energy, and we're going to define E of yw as the min over z of E of yzw, okay? So plug a y, find the value of z that minimizes the sum of those two energies, okay? And then the value you get, that's your energy function. And it turns out it's a very general view of a lot of unsupervised learning algorithms that you wouldn't think fit into that model actually do fit into that model. So in particular, I don't understand why this picture never shows up. So this is kind of another way of representing that structure, but which is sort of make it more apparent of its kind of symmetry, right? You run through the encoder and the cost function measures the discrepancy between the code and y, and then the other one measures the discrepancy between the decoded y, produced by running through the decoder and the original y, sum the two, perhaps with the coefficient for one of the two terms, and that's your energy function. So an interesting thing about this is that it's completely reversible, so there's no really any difference of role between y and z. You could, you know, they're kind of interchangeable. And the basic idea of deep learning is that we're going to take a whole bunch of those modules, so I didn't draw the second cost function here for kind of clarity reasons. We can train those things in isolation, and we can stack them up. We can stack multiple instances of it to create kind of deep architectures. And because they're trained unsupervised, we don't run into the sort of deep learning problem I was talking about earlier. So it's kind of the way to get around it. Okay, so there are several classical models of learning that fall into the category. PCA falls into that model completely. So PCA basically has an encoder that's linear, a decoder that's linear, and the only constraint is that the code, the Z code, has to have a lower dimension than Y. Okay, and the energy is simply the reconstruction error. There is no first energy term. There's only a second one. Okay, and that's it. K-means is kind of a weird version of this, where there's no encoder. I'm sorry. Okay. So K-means you could view as just this part. We just have a reconstruction error, and the z variable is discrete. It's basically which of the prototypes you choose. Okay, and the prototypes are in there. The two encoder neural nets are kind of an obvious special case of this. And then there's various algorithms for sparse or complete representations that could be cast into that model as well. But let me talk about a particular, restricted Boltzmann machine, the kind of model that Russ talked about yesterday, also falls into the category. But there's another interesting class of models, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, that force the code to be sparse. And so basically, what we're going to do is, let me back up a little bit. So PCA is a model by which you take an input vector, project it into a smaller dimensional space, and then reconstruct, right? And the energy is a reconstruction error. And reconstruction error is going to be zero when the input point is on the plane on which you project. And it's going to be non-zero otherwise. It's going to be the reconstruction error, which is the distance between the point and the plane, right? If the dimension of the project of the space you project on is equal to the dimension of the input, then the system just computes the identity function. So now the energy surface is zero everywhere. The reconstruction error is zero everywhere. It's not an interesting model at all. Okay? So the reason why the model is interesting is because it gives low energy to some points and high energy to other points. If you have a model that gives low energy to everything, it doesn't do anything for you. It's just the identity function. Okay. So how do we make sure that only some of the points are properly reconstructed and most of the points are not? And a simple way of doing this is to make sure that there is a limited amount of information in the code. So if the code only carries 5 bits, there's only 32 possible configurations for the code, okay? That means there's only 32 possible values that are produced by the output of the decoder, okay? So that means there's only 32 input vectors that are going to be exactly reconstructed. Everything else is going to have a high reconstruction error, a high energy, okay? So limiting the information in the code, the amount of information in the code, is a way of making sure the energy surface has a high value almost everywhere and a small value only a kind of a small subset of data points. And I'm going to sort of demonstrate this with kind of a little toy example here. So let's say we have this little toy example. Our input vector is a two-dimensional vector. Now our training samples are sampled around this little spiral here. Okay. And we're going to try to train an unsupervised learning algorithm to give us low energy around the spiral, high energy everywhere else. So we can use PCA, right? So PCA with one component, because the input vector has two dimensions, so we get to project on one dimension, all right? And that's the subset that, that's the plane that PCA finds, or the line that PCA finds, okay? So it tries to find the principal component of that cloud of point here, which is kind of densely sampled. And that's kind of the principal axis, so it says, you know, that's the way of kind of minimizing the e squared error of distance from any of those points to that plane. And this is a representation of the energy surface. So it's zero here, and it's kind of a quadratic ball as you move away from that point. This is what k-means give you. Okay, so k-means here, we're going to pick 20 prototypes and run the k-means algorithm. And it's going to put the prototypes sort of equally spaced around this little spiral and give you this really nice looking energy function that works really well. Okay. Zero reconstruction error for those points, high reconstruction error for anything away from those points. Okay, so it's got the right shape for the energy function. Of course, k-means doesn't work all the time, particularly it doesn't work with very high dimensional spaces.
Plug.
Plug. Yes. So this is kind of another. So this is an example where we use a contrastive loss. So here we explicitly, so we have a neural net, some non-linearly parameter transformation, doesn't matter what it is. And you push down on the energy of some points, and you push up on the energy of nearby points, very similar to the contrastive divergence idea. And you get this kind of nice looking energy surface as well. But unfortunately, that doesn't work really well in high dimension, because there's just too many points to pull up. And this is what you get if you force the code to be sparse. So here, it's an autoencoder neural net, so it's got two layers. But the middle layer is forced to kind of only have a few units that are non-zero. And so it can't carry a lot of information. And because of that, it sort of creates this kind of nice looking energy surface as well. So we can apply this to this idea to this sort of encoder-decoder architecture. By forcing the code to be sparse. So we're going to take an input vector, run it through the encoder, and then run the code through a bunch of logistic functions that have a high bias, or a high threshold, in such a way that at the output here, only a few components are non-zero. Okay? So it's kind of an unusual way for, you know, sort of L1 regularizer mathematician to kind of sparsify some representation. Here, what we do is we basically just pass the the vector from the encoder to the sort of high threshold nonlinear transformation, so that most of them are, you know, turn out to be zero. And then run through the decoder and compute the reconstruction error. And we're going to train the system, train the parameter of the encoder and the decoder to minimize reconstruction error. But it can't do a good job at it because it's got this really bad sparsifying logistic in the middle. And the nice thing about this is that if you train this on Hamilton digits, these are the filters you get. So these are the rows in the matrix. This is actually the decoder matrix, I believe. So these are the basis functions, if you want, that you can use to reconstruct. So basically, any digit is a weighted sum of a small number, a linear combination of a small number of those guys. Okay, it's a sparse reconstruction. And the result is that the basis functions end up being parts of digits, because the best way to build a digit with a small number of parts is to kind of decompose it into little strokes. And so those basis functions end up being strokes of digits. That's kind of cool. If you apply this to natural images, you get sort of Gabor filter-like things. Not quite, but sort of. Sort of, you know, edge detectors. They look very much like what neuroscientists tell us they find in sort of early areas of the visual system. There's a kind of another version of it where, more recent one, that's what I'm going to end by, where I'm going to go into the details of this, but it's basically a way of learning those basis functions in a way that they are movable. So, so instead of learning a set of basis functions in such a way that any training sample can be reconstructed as a linear combination of a small number of those basis functions, we allow those basis functions to move around. Okay, so we search over positions as well. Okay, and the architecture to do this, the algorithm to do this is not that complicated, but I don't have to go time to go into the details of this. And what you get is something like this. If you apply this to the handwritten digit I showed, these are the filters you get. And there are, again, pieces of characters, strokes, but now they're movable parts. So now you can reconstruct a character by a linear combination of those guys, but you can move them around. So for example, this little 9 here is the sum of, or weighted sum with coefficients that are close to 1 of all of those basis functions, which are a subset of the ones that I showed earlier. And the red frame here indicates which position you have to put them at to kind of reconstruct this this knot.
Can you go between the two? Should be there at once. Are these simpler? The ones are more complicated.
So we have a smaller number of those. We have 15 instead of 200. They're bigger. And they're somewhat similar, yes.
The other ones more.
So the other ones look like this. So they're a little more contrasted, actually.
Yeah.
A little bigger. There's more of them. So it's hard to compare. Now, an interesting comparison is restricted Boltzmann machine. So this is the filters that are produced by the algorithm that Russ talked about yesterday. And you don't get parts, you get bubbles. Or sort of mushy things. It's really strange. So there's that. So you can use this for compression, and you can use this for object recognition. So the last thing I want to say is that we use this to train the filters of a convolutional net. So instead of using, so it's the same architecture that I showed before with which we recognize those objects, except it's a little bigger. Instead of training it entirely supervised by backpropagating gradient through it, we train each layer using this little movable part algorithm unsupervised, using data which actually are not from the same training set. We train it on different images. And so we train the first layer of filters using images like this that come from the Caltech 101 dataset. Well, we're using other images actually for the filters. And we get a nice bunch of little filters, something like 64 of them. And then we take the output of that first layer and we plug it into another layer of the same type and we train it again unsupervised. And we get another set of filters. And in the end, we put the whole system together. It looks like a convolutional net. So these are the filters, the first layer filters that end up being learned. These are the second layer filters, that's a small subset of them. I can't really explain why they look like this. And plug this into a big neural net, and on Caltech 101, you get something like 54% correct, which is not record-breaking by any means. You know, when we produced this, this was about 8% below the best performance, best performing system of the time. Now it's there's much better systems to that repeat that by a lot. But the interesting comparison is, if you train the same network completely supervised using backprop, you get 20% correct. Okay, so unsupervised training is a huge help here. There's no question about it. Okay, so that's it.